Turning now to the first book of Samuel, chapter 29, verse 1. 1 Samuel, chapter 29, verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, and the Israelites pitched by a fountain which is in Jezreel. Well, we've come to the point in the life of David where he is living in Ziklag, down in the south, what was supposed to be territory of Judah. He is a guest of Achish, king of Gath. Achish was the first of the five lords of the Philistines, the senior of them, and the only one of the five lords of the Philistines who was styled as a king. And he had taken in David. David had fled to him from Saul. And we've seen previously it was a disastrous thing to do. It was a great mistake. It was the second time he'd done it. God had commanded him to stay in Judah through the prophet Gad, but he got into a very depressed state of mind. Even after a time when he'd had a remarkable deliverance from the hand of Saul, and he said to himself, it's in the beginning of chapter 27, I will now one day surely perish, be killed by Saul. And so he went to Achish. Now he must have had some reason to believe that Achish would be hospitable to him, and he was. And he stayed in Ziklag for, if we understand the record correctly, something like a year and 4 months, and he conducted raiding parties into Philistine territory and even Amalekite territory. And all the time he misled Achish, king of Gath, into thinking that he was raiding his own people, the Israelites. So David got into this period of his life where he disobeyed God, although he never ceased to be a believer. He put himself in an outrageous and impossible situation, and he frequently lied to cover his activities. Of course, the Israelites were delighted with him because they were being attacked by the Philistines, marauding, raiding parties. And it was David down there who'd in Ziklag who would retaliate and respond, not Saul, and it was Saul's calling to do this, but David was doing it. But of course, it was quite out of keeping with his being guest of the first lord of the Philistines who had given him that city, and so he had to lie constantly and show excessive cruelty to his enemies so that none ever survived to tell the story that might find its way back to the king of Gath. Well, David's life is a remarkable life. Times and periods of strong faith and great victories in the Lord. And times also of sad failure when he slipped away from the place where God would have him be and protect him. You know, the old writers all used to say of the life of David, it's a remarkable life to be recorded in the scripture in such detail, because every believer, no matter whether we're walking in faith or we're in failure and we've fallen into some foolish way, every believer finds himself or herself somewhere depicted in the life of David. And it's absolutely true. And whether it is to recover from failure and loss, or whether it is to handle triumph and victory, we all come to the life of David and we can see lessons and a way of escape and God's great goodness to bring us to recovery. So not only were some aspects of the life of David remarkable in that he typifies Christ himself, but not in his failings, of course. There are, all taken altogether, it's a life full of spiritual lessons for us. Now, at the beginning of chapter 29, David's position is impossible. Well, at the beginning of chapter 28, we were introduced to it. It came to pass in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for warfare to fight with Israel. And Achish, king of Gath, David's host, said unto David, "Know now thou assuredly that thou shalt go out with me to battle, thou and thy men." Well, how could David do that? If he went out to battle with the Philistines against his own people, how would God's purpose for him ever be fulfilled? How could the Israelites receive him and trust him as king in the event of the death of Saul if he had made himself their enemy and their executioner? Of course, this was an impossible position, and we can only assume that David, though he couldn't conveniently and easily just clear off, we must assume that he looked to God to be delivered from the impossible position he'd put himself in. And we can get into that kind of position, but I mention this only in passing, by trusting worldly things, trusting to worldly things, getting ourselves into worldliness. Well, it led to David's impossible position. But I think he must have hoped and prayed that while Achish wanted him to engage on the Philistine side against Israel, that the other lords of the Philistines, once they heard about it, wouldn't have it and wouldn't stand for it. And fortunately for David, by the superintendency of God in these affairs, that's exactly what happened, and that's what is told us here in chapter 29, which I won't go into in detail, but the record here is verse 3 of chapter 29. Then said the princes of the Philistines, the other four lords, "What do these Hebrews here?" Although David had taken up a position nervously at the very back of their armies. And Achish said unto the princes of the Philistines, "Is not this David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel? And he's been with me these days or these years, and I have found no fault in him." But the princes of the Philistines were very angry, and they insisted, and Achish had to relent. There were interesting things in this chapter, which I won't stay with, because Achish comes across as almost a believer in the Lord. It's quite remarkable. Verse 6, "Then Achish called David and said unto him, Surely as the Lord liveth..." Which Lord? There were, of course, several Philistine gods, but it's in the singular. It's almost as though Achish is very influenced by David, even though they're not in this anywhere near each other in proximity in their dwellings. But this is the language of Achish, and it's quite remarkable. Well, nevertheless, David has to be dismissed. And so, verse 11 of chapter 29, David and his men rose up early to depart in the morning. Now, they'd gone up north to gather at Aphek, which was some 50 to 55 miles north of Ziklag, where David and his 600 men had taken over the town. That was down in the south, in the territory of Judah. So they'd had something like a 50-mile forced march to the north to go to Aphek to assemble with the Philistines, and now they have a 50-mile forced march south again back to Ziklag, and it all takes time. So that brings us to chapter 30. It came to pass, when David and his men were come to Ziklag on the third day, that the Amalekites had invaded the south, not just Ziklag, but a great amount of Philistine-held territory down there, and Israelite territory. But at Ziklag, they'd cut it down and burned it with fire. So there was Ziklag, the town where David and his 600 men and all their wives and families, the wives, the families, the youngsters, had been left there, it appears, pretty well unguarded. And the city was destroyed, And the houses, the stone houses, were blackened, and the roofs burned with fire. It was just nothing but ash and cinder and smoke rising, smouldering. And the families had gone. There was no sign of executions. They'd just been carried away, either to be sold into slavery or used as slaves by the Amalekites who had carried out this invasion. Verse 2, they'd taken the women captives that were therein. They slew not any, either great or small, adults or children, but carried them away and went their way. So in verse 3, you read of David and his men coming back after this trip to the north and seeing the disaster and all their families taken. And verse 4, they lifted up their voice and wept until they had no more power to weep. They were utterly distraught, and not surprisingly. They'd lost personally their families, their homes, their possessions. The cause, of course, these people had been with David, and although David had fled into Philistine territory, they had never been hurt while they'd been with David until that moment. They were all riffraff from society, debtors and inadequates, but they'd gone to David, and there he had them under his command, and Saul had been chasing them before they went into Philistine territory, and always they'd been remarkably delivered. He'd never found them, he'd never brought them down. So this is shattering, because they've got a sense of superiority about them, and they believe in David. Even though he's disobeyed the Lord and he's made a false move, they believe in him. This man is going to be king. He is invincible. He is our leader. And now everything has gone, completely broken and shattered. And so you read in verse 6, and David was greatly distressed. And the Hebrew is very strong indeed. It means, literally, David was greatly narrowed. The idea of the Hebrew word is to say you're, yes, distressed, but you've been so hemmed in on every side, you're in a situation from which there's no escape. What can David do? He cannot restore the families, the homes. He can't restore the goods and possessions. At least, he doesn't believe he can. There is no escape from this situation. Now he's a failure, and there's great bitterness. And again, that comes through in this sixth verse. For the people spake of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved. And the Hebrew is bitter. They were resentful. There was deep anger and bitterness. Grieved, not in just a good sense, an understandable sense, because of loss, but they were angry and resentful and deeply embittered. And David didn't know which way to go, where to turn. His situation was hopeless. Now, he'd broken under stress himself, but at the end of verse 6, but David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. He encouraged himself. This is enormously important to us and very valuable. It sounds almost callous. There is everybody wailing and bitter and angry, and David encourages himself. Well, perhaps the word doesn't sit very well in the sentence. It's perfect translation. Again, let me tell you that the Hebrew is an interesting word. Generally translated, a translation would be that David strengthened himself. But the word in the Hebrew comes from bound. David bound himself, rather as if you're using a collection of loose stones to build a wall, and you use mortar to bind them together and make them a strong unit. Or the harvest is on and you're binding sheaves, or binding anything that needs tying together. That's the Hebrew. David uses the word strengthened in terms of bound himself. In modern language, we would say that David before on some occasions, had gone to pieces. Now he's doing the opposite. He's binding himself together. That's the Hebrew literally. Encouraged is a perfectly good translation. He's in a tight corner. He's distressed beyond any human way of describing. Everything is going wrong, but now he pulls himself together and binds himself and strengthens himself in the Lord. Now, this is why this narrative is so helpful and so important to us. There is one translation, it's the NIV, that says something like this: and David got strength from the Lord. And that's wrong. He did, of course, but the translation is the exact translation, and most of the modern versions have it the same way as our King James Version: David strengthened himself in the Lord. That's different from obtain strength from the Lord. He didn't just pray, which he must have done, but he didn't just pray, Lord, help me. He did something to strengthen himself in the Lord. He couldn't have strengthened himself by human reasoning only, by drawing upon some human comforts or encouragements. He could only strengthen himself in the Lord, but he followed some procedure. Now, this is just where we often go wrong when we're in pieces and we need to bind ourselves together. We might call on the Lord, but do we know there is a procedure by which we can take steps to get strength in the Lord? And that's what he does. Earlier on, David talked with himself and depressed himself mightily, looking only at the negative aspects of his position. That's 27, verse chapter 27, when he told himself that his position was hopeless and he was doomed. Now he talks to himself again, but this time with positive things, with the promises of God and the undertakings of the Lord. Now, when troubles come, even if the troubles are our own faults entirely, there is a way out for Christians with the Lord. There is such a thing as saving faith when we need salvation, and there is such a thing as saving faith when we are saved, but we need rescue from some foolish situation we've got into. And David took certain steps of faith to re-strengthen himself and get back to where he should have been. These were constructive steps, so he encouraged himself and set about the recovery. In the Lord, he remembered obviously the love of God to him. He remembered his anointing to be king. He remembered all the blessings from the past. He remembered his love to God and the trust he had always placed in him. He remembered these things. He remembered the mercy of God, the calling of God. We should remember all those things. If we've done foolish things, and we've put ourselves in foolish situations, and we've slipped away from our walk with God, faith must be exercised. There's mercy with him. He is ready to have us back and restore us, but we have some steps to take. We don't just stand helpless and say, Lord, help me. We certainly do that, but we take the steps, and we remember and we encourage ourselves by the way God saved us and the wonderful things he's done for us and the times when we've trusted him completely. We remember his promises: he which hath begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. We remember these things. Remember the evidences. I would think that David thought about the slaying of Goliath. Impossible, that situation, that one young man could have such success. I'm sure he would have thought about Saul, an expert, hurling javelins at him from close quarters, and never once hitting him. I'm sure he would have thought of the cave at Engedi and occasions when amazing things had happened and God delivered him. And he re-strengthened himself and encouraged himself and rededicated himself. So here he was reaping the whirlwind. Everything was going wrong. He was rejected by Saul, rejected now by his friend, the king of Gath. Ziklag had been destroyed. His men had turned against him. Everything was going against him. But that whirlwind and that tempest was a message from heaven to bring him back to trust and commitment and rededication to his God. And he came back. Well, verse 7 of chapter 30. David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, I pray thee, bring me hither the ephod. And Abiathar brought it. Where had that been? Where had Abiathar been? Well, clearly he'd been with David. I would imagine, even on the journey up to Aphek, 50 miles there, 50 miles back, the ephod was with David all the time. If it hadn't been, then Abiathar would have been taken with everybody else by the Amalekites, and the ephod would be gone and nowhere to be found. Well, why do I mention this? Because David had Abiathar with him and the ephod all the time, and he never seems to have consulted it until now. Same with us. When we go a-wandering and we do something foolish or we backslide, the Lord is there, the ephod is there, if you like. Abiathar is there, in our case, a much better Abiathar, the nearness of Christ himself, all the time. It's just we who do not turn to him. That's our trouble when we're wayward. But now David turns and seeks. He could have done it long before. Verse 8, and David inquired at the Lord, saying, shall I pursue after this troop? Shall I overtake them? And the Lord answered him, pursue, for thou shalt surely overtake them, and without fail recover all. Well, that was a message for David and the 600 who were with him. And nevertheless, his troubles aren't over. There's still going to be a test of faith, because he discovers that one-third of his men are not capable of pursuing the Amalekites. Now, from the scale of the destruction and the theft, it was clear to David, it would have been, that there were, who knows, thousands of Amalekites. A raiding party, one would think, of at least 2, 3, 4, 5 thousand. And that's confirmed when you see how long it took for them to be dealt with by David. And David only has 600 men. So that requires faith. And when 200 of them, they get just a little way, a few miles, to the brook Besor, which at the time of year would have been quite a torrent, quite at high level. 1/3 of his men were not capable of making the crossing. Why not? Well, the 50 miles north and the 50 miles back in a few days had just knocked them for six. They were not up to it. They were probably not all young by any means. So that's a test of faith. And another test of faith is, although a large gathering of men leaves some sort of a trail, the trail was soon lost and they had no idea where they were. They had gone across the brook, their numbers had been reduced. How was this ever going to be brought to pass? But now David is renewed in faith, and so are many of the others, and God provides guidance. And so, down in verse 11, they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David and gave him bread, and he did eat, and they made him drink water, gave him a piece of a cake of figs and 2 clusters of raisins. They had no idea that this Egyptian was part of the Amalekite, this young man as he turned out to be, part of the Amalekite party. Rather nice, I think, that they were prepared to revive to life a young man who seems to be dying that they find. And David said to him, verse 13, "To whom belongest thou, and whence art thou?" And he told them he was a youngster of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite who'd been abandoned because he was sick, and it turns out hadn't eaten or drunk anything for 3 days. And he knows about the invasion of the Kerethites and the coastal cities of Judah and south of Caleb, and how they burned Ziklag with fire. And he also knew where the base was that they'd worked from. David asked him this in verse 15, and it's interesting that the Egyptian, he's quite smart, this young Egyptian, even though he's just been revived. He knows David is an Israelite, and so he uses Israelite language. He said, "Swear unto me by God," singular God, Israelite God, "that thou wilt neither kill me nor deliver me into the hands of my master." He knows all of a sudden how to be a monotheist. "And I will bring thee down to this company." And there he brought them. And another amazing factor, there was not really going to be much resistance. Most of these Amalekites seem to be drunk or halfway there. And so David is able to begin to deal with that murderous raiding party, with the exception of detail of 400 who escaped on camels. Well, how many must there have been? If the language says there escaped not a man of them save 400, implying that that's only a small fraction of the army that had been marshalled by the Amalekites. And David recovered everything. And there was absolutely nothing missing. But he not only recovered everything, but there was vast spoil, because they'd been raiding huge areas of territory. And David took all the flocks and the herds, look at verse 20 there, "which they," his party, his 400, "drave before those other cattle, and they," the party, the 400, "said, this is David's spoil." In other words, David's renewal of his faith, his consulting of God, his calming the whole situation down when they were going to kill him, strengthening himself in the Lord and taking hold of the situation. Well, everybody knew David's faith had been resuscitated, and he'd renewed his covenant with God, and God was with him, and something which seemed impossible had happened as the result. And the old David and his victories and his conquests was back. And so they said, all this, masses of it, is David's spoil. And he got the credit, but he didn't take it. And this is a lesson for us too. A lot of that people in that party of 400 were pretty wicked people and low people, and they wanted the 200 that couldn't come to be excluded from receiving any of the spoil. And in verse 23, "Then said David, ye shall not do so, my brethren, with that which the Lord hath given us, who hath preserved us and delivered the company that came against us into our hands." And that should be our kind of language. Everything that we're enabled to accomplish for the Lord, he has done it, friends, not us. It's his arrows of conviction that enter hearts and cause people to profess Christ. It's not us. We do the work, but he blesses it and he makes it possible. And so ends that 29th chapter with the distribution of spoil to towns, to cities in Israel that had helped David. And then I come to chapter 31. Now, the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down slain in Mount Gilboa. What a terrible place, and a place of terrible memories that became. Verse 22, "And the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons, and they slew Jonathan and two of the others. And verse 3, the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him. And it's generally assumed that it is the archers that hit the sons too, because they were all relatively close together. And so it seems to be archers that did the damage. And he was sore wounded of the archers. And you know this passage. Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw thy sword and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and abuse me, kill me and abuse me." Saul at the end has no faith. All he seems to be concerned about is his dignity and his honor. He's going to be taken and mocked and abused by the Philistines. So he orders his armor-bearer to do something which was against God's law. Now there was time to withdraw. Saul could have got away. We know that because the Philistines didn't come and clear up the battlefield until the next day. They were not that close. They were not near. He could have got away and his armor-bearer, but he was in utter despair when he saw the retreat, the fleeing of the Israelites. He didn't know what to do. He was all to pieces, once a man of courage, and he was in despair, so he could only think of ending his life. His armor-bearer wouldn't do it. Of course he wouldn't. An armor-bearer was supposed to preserve the person he served, the king, to the very end, stand between him and the arrows, and so on. And the armor-bearer possibly feared that if he took the king's life, they'd certainly take his. And when the king took his own life, well, the despair of Saul spread to his armor-bearer and those around him, and his armor-bearer took his life also. And you read in verse 7 these terrible accounts when the men of Israel that were on the other side of the valley and they that were on the other side Jordan saw that the men of Israel fled and that Saul and his sons were dead. They forsook the cities and they just gave up cities and territory to the Philistines, who gradually came in and took them. But the day after the battle, the Philistines came to strip the slain, and then they found Saul and his three sons fallen in Mount Gilboa. And verse 9, they cut off his head and stripped off his armour, sent into the land of the Philistines round about to publish it in the house of their idols. Part of him was hung on a wall at Bethshan, that's in verse 10, his armour in the house of the goddess Ashtaroth, his head in the shrine of Dagon, we're told in 1 Chronicles. And in verse 11, the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead heard of that which the Philistines had done to Saul, and the valiant men, not so valiant, the valiant men arose. Bethshan, that was the great fortress town of central Palestine, and the Philistines took it, and they hung the bodies out for the vultures on the walls of that fortress town of Israel. But the men of Jabesh came and rescued them and burned them so that they were out of further abuse and harm. Why the men of Jabesh weren't in the battle is anybody's guess. They'd kept themselves out of trouble on previous occasions. They took their bones. But just going in to the second book of Samuel, chapter 1, verse 1. Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had abode 2 days in Ziklag, he was totally taken by surprise. Down in Ziklag, perhaps he would have considered, I'm sure he would have done, joining with the battle. But the Philistine invasion was so fast and their victory so instant, so immediate, the whole thing was so dramatic, that in the time it took David to pursue the Amalekites, to rescue the wives and families, get back to Ziklag and be there in just 2 days, well, the Israelites had fallen. Everything had collapsed. He could not take part. Nothing could happen. And then this event, which puzzles people, took place very quickly. Verse 2 of 2nd Book of Samuel, chapter 1. It came to pass on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul, with his clothes rent and earth upon his head. And so it was, when he came to David, that he fell to the earth and did obeisance. And David said unto him, From whence comest thou? And he said unto him, Out of the camp of Israel I am escaped. Now it's probable that by now David knew the bad news, but he didn't know that the royal family had been killed, Jonathan and Saul. And verse 4, David said unto him, How went the matter, I pray thee, tell me? And he was told that the people had fled, the battle was lost, many, many people were fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan are dead also. And David thought this might just be rumour, verse 5. And he said to the young man, How do you know that Saul and Jonathan be dead? And the young man told this amazing story. Verse 6, an Amalekite young man, as it happened. As I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa, a very likely story, isn't it? That a stray Amalekite is wandering around a battlefield in the midst of all the commotion, and he just happens to be taking a stroll. That's not exactly what he says. And he happens to see the decisive moments of the battle. Oh no, surely this young man hadn't been anywhere near that scene, not on the at the time it all happened. This chap was a corpse raider, an Amalekite who goes round the battlefield between the Philistines and the Israelites, once everything has died down, to take valuables from the corpses. He was a corpse stripper from among the Amalekites, nothing other than that. As I happened, verse 6, by chance upon Mount Gilboa, behold, Saul leaned upon his spear. Well, the official record said it was a sword. This is a spear. And lo, the chariots and horsemen followed hard after him. That's extremely unlikely that the Philistine chariots and horsemen were there on the spot, because they didn't know they'd got Saul until the next day, when the Philistines came to clean up the battlefield. So that seems to be most unlikely. This is a fiction. Verse 7, And when he looked upon him, that is the young Amalekite, he saw me and called unto me, and I answered, Here am I. This is fabrication. Verse 8, And he said unto me, Who art thou? And I answered him, I am an Amalekite. Now the significance of that is, of course, I am a neutral. It was the Philistines who were attacking the Israelites, not the Amalekites. So he was neither an Israelite nor a Philistine. He was a neutral. And on hearing that in his story, verse 9, Saul said, Stand, I pray thee, upon me and slay me, for anguish is come upon me, because my life is yet whole in me. I've tried to take my life, in other words, and I'm still alive. Kill me, finish me off. So verse 10, this Amalekite says, So I stood upon him and slew him, because I was sure that he could not live after that he was fallen. And I took the crown that was upon his head and the bracelet that was upon his arm, and have brought them hither unto my lord. Why? He's clearly stripped bodies on the battlefield, an opportunist corpse stripper, getting in there before the Philistines come and clear the field themselves. But why does he feel obliged to tell David he finished Saul off? And the best explanation is he's judging David according to himself. He thinks David, because he was pursued by Saul and Saul was hostile to him, will be delighted to know that Saul is dead. And so he'll get credit and money, not only for handing over the crown and the royal bracelet, but also for killing Saul. He's trying to get as much out of David as he can, this corpse stripper. He won't take the crown and the bracelet to the Philistines. They'll only murder him and pocket them. But no, he's trying to cash in on this as much as he can. And so David took hold of his clothes, his own clothes, that is, verse 11, and rent them, and likewise all the men that were with them. And they mourned and wept and fasted until even for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. David, oh, he may have been pursued by Saul, but he was deeply distressed by his death. And David said unto the man that told him, "Whence art thou?" And he answered, "I am the son of a stranger, an Amalekite." And David condemns him for having, according to his own story, killed the Lord's anointed. And he has him executed. He was an Amalekite, and he was a corpse stripper, and he had claimed to be the hand that killed the king rather than rescued him. But then I want to, as I close, take just a few minutes only, tell you a remarkable thing that comes in this passage, and it is from verse 17. And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan, his son. Verse 18, here's a controversial verse, I'll tell you why. "Also he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher," which was a book, evidently, of the victories and the military preparations and prowess, wars of Israel. But here's the controversial part. "Also he bade them teach the children of Judah," see the words in italics, "the use of the bow." The Hebrew just says, "He bade them teach the children of Judah the bow." And then his lament begins properly in verse 19. Now, the modern translations, mostly, certainly since the Revised Standard Version, the Old Testament of which was done in the 40s, which was a liberal translation, they all go for a different rendering of this. And it's to me, it's very interesting. I hope it is to you. And they all say, "He bade them teach the children of Judah the song of the bow." Or they bade him teach the lament to the tune of the bow. And sometimes they don't put those extra words in italics. The NIV doesn't. The song of the bow is not in italics. They're not admitting to the readers that they've added the words. The Hebrew doesn't mention a song. It doesn't mention a lament. The natural rendering of the passage is as in the King James Version, with these words added to help us. "He bade them teach the children of Judah the bow," or in other words, how to use the bow. Well, why is that right? Why should we assume that the King James translators have got this right, the use of the bow, and not the modern translations who assume that this must be the name of the lament? Well, one reason is that nowhere in the Bible is a psalm given a name, or a lament, or a song. It's just not the style or the manner. Oh, they're given some tunes in the inscriptions above the Psalms, but nowhere is anything given a name. And why should David's lament be called the Song of the Bow? A bow is mentioned, the bow of Jonathan in verse 22, but it's a general lament. But there's every reason why David should command not only this song, but that the children, the rising generation in Israel, learns how to use the bow. Because Jonathan, his dearest friend, and probably his two brothers, there was a third brother, wasn't there, four of them altogether, children of Saul, and probably Saul himself, were all killed by the bow. Humanly speaking, what carried the battle was that the Philistines were dead shots in archery, and the Israelites had practically abandoned the bow. So the most natural thing, we're going to learn a lament, but we must teach the rising generation to learn to use the bow. This decimation must never happen again, where our enemies are skilled in this weapon and we have dropped it. Jonathan was a skilled archer. David remembers that. Remember the time of his covenant with Jonathan? Jonathan was always carrying a bow, shooting a bow in the royal grounds, and so on. He was a great archer. So there it is. Philistine superiority. This must never happen again. Israelite inferiority. The reason for the fall of Saul and Jonathan and the others was the bow. This was a memorial to Jonathan, the most wonderful archer. Let's teach the bow to the youngsters. In other words, this is a little verse, verse 18 in here, which has a lesson for us. In all our calamities, learn the lessons. Why did I fall? Why did I stray? I strayed, somebody might say, because my television screen was much too big. Then learn the lesson and get rid of that size of television screen if it enticed you overmuch. Let's learn archery, says David. Bring up the new generation. Let's learn from our mistakes. Well, I could give you ever so many examples. I must learn more the use of prayer. That's the best bow there is for a Christian. I must learn much more the art of witness. I must learn much more the art of self-examination. What let me down, we may say, is my lack of self-discipline. And so I dropped my devotions, and they got frittered away next to nothing. What let me down was my lack of personal discipline. I must learn the art of self-discipline. That 18th verse is very important. David was anxious that the Israelites should learn from their failure and their mistakes. Well, our time is up. You've been very, very patient. I'd like to deal with the lament, but another time. It's a wonderful lament, and there's some astonishing sentiments in it. But that's enough for us this evening. Let's conclude singing together the hymn 506. Hymn 506.